Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, making sense of Syria, unraveling the many geopolitical players and their agendas, and the U.S. failures in the Middle East and Syria. We have two people today. First up will be Dr. Garth Porter. Dr. Porter is an award-winning historian, an independent investigative journalist, and a policy analyst who specializes in U.S. geopolitics and national security issues. During the Vietnam War, he was Dispatch News Services Bureau Chief in Saigon, and later a co-director for the Indochina Resource Center. In addition to being a specialist in Vietnamese and Cambodian affairs, he has been reporting on the Middle East, including the chemical gas attacks reported in Syria, for the past decade. His numerous articles can be found in Foreign Affairs, Al Jazeera, Huffington Post, Counterpunch, Truthout, The Nation, and others. For the past 9 years, he has been investigating U.S. and Israeli tensions with Iran and the U.S. intelligence operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Garth has an M.A. in International Relations from the University of Chicago and a doctorate in Southeast Asian Studies from Cornell University. He's published 5 major books dealing with Vietnam and Cambodia. His most recent is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Also, after this, we will speak with Professor Stephen Zunis. He is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle Eastern Studies. He is recognized as one of the country's leading scholars of U.S. Middle East policy and strategic nonviolent action. He received his Ph.D. from Cornell University and previously served on the faculty of Ithaca College, as well as the University of Puget Sound and Whitman College. And he is also an author. We'll begin with you, Garth. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Gary.
Both the Arab Spring and the rise of ISIS have introduced bolts from the blue, as they say in chaos theory, or black swans that have thoroughly disrupted the U.S. and its allies' geopolitical goals in the Middle East. Consequently, we're watching Iraq return to complete basket case status. Afghanistan has returned to such unruliness and conflict that the White House needs to now remain militarily present there. And now Russia has entered the equation by coming to Assad's assistance to remove the threats from ISIS and other anti-Assad militant organizations. All of these events are really symptoms and not causes. If the U.S. has never invaded Iraq, there is no knowing how the Middle East would fare today. And behind the U.S. invasion of Iraq, there was a set of global strategies, a geopolitical blueprint and timeframes to reshape the Middle East into the U.S.'s image for the region. So please begin by analyzing for us the U.S.'s strategic plan for the Middle East, starting with Iraq, and how this policy has now led to the worsening of conditions that we find today with civil war in Syria, the birth and growth of ISIS, and the collapse and splintering of Iraq into an unstable, unmanageable region. The forum is yours.
Right. Thanks very much. I think you've correctly framed the problem that we now see in the Middle East, and particularly the tragedy, the complete disintegration and humanitarian crisis in Syria. And also, I have to add, a second humanitarian crisis because of a war to which the United States, for which the United States does, in fact, have a great deal of responsibility. And that is Yemen, which doesn't get as much news coverage as Syria, but the humanitarian crisis there is equally grave and in some ways even more intense. So to answer your question, in the most general sense, I think we do have to go back to many years ago when the United States first created the kind of Frankenstein monster that we have seen take shape in recent years, when the U.S. created, with the help of the Saudis, and Pakistan, the Mujahideen force in Afghanistan, to supposedly get the Russians out of Afghanistan. And as a result of that policy of deliberately creating a jihadist force, a military political force, we saw the eventual creation of Al-Qaeda, which, of course, was the product of Osama bin Laden, one of the facilitators of that policy of the United States, of creating the jihadi force to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan. And so there's a direct correlation, a direct relationship, cause and effect, between that original U.S. intervention through the CIA and the rise of Al-Qaeda, which then, of course, created the possibility for Al-Qaeda to take shape in Iraq only, as you correctly point out, because of the U.S. invasion. I think most of your listeners may remember that before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, Al-Qaeda had no presence in that country, and it was only because of the opportunity given to Al-Qaeda to move in to the open political space created by the U.S. war there that Al-Qaeda really had a chance to gain a foothold and eventually then to be able to take advantage of the opportunity of the uprising, the popular uprising in Syria in 2011 against the Assad regime. And to move into Syria and become really the two major forces opposed to the Assad regime. That is the ISIS, the Islamic State, on one hand, and the Syrian franchise, if you will, of Al-Qaeda, which is operating as al-Nusra Front today. And so what we find now is that this is really fundamentally a three-cornered war between the two jihadi forces, that is the Islamic State and al-Nusra Front and its allies, and the Syrian government under the Assad regime. It is not a war where you have a moderate alternative. You don't have a pro-Western alternative to support. And that's where I think the Obama administration and the news media in the United States are being very deeply misleading in regard to their coverage of the war. They're still suggesting that there's somehow a moderate force there that the United States can and does try to support, and that they're being frustrated now by the Russians who are intervening and somehow targeting this moderate opposition force that, I'm sorry to say, it really doesn't exist in any meaningful way. The moderates have all either disappeared or they have actually become allies of al-Nusra Front, of al-Qaeda.
I appreciate that insight, Gareth. Now, unless I miss something, the United States tends to get it wrong in every case. We got it wrong in Vietnam. We got it wrong in Iraq. We got it wrong in Afghanistan. And if we really want to see wrong, why don't we take a look at what we were supporting, the moderate people in Libya. Take a look at Libya today compared to what it was before we intervened, and tell me what any of this means as far as bringing stability, democracy, and freedom to the Middle East. To the contrary, look at every country we supported militarily and diplomatically for the last 30 years. Egypt, a dictatorship, military dictatorship, but a dictatorship nonetheless, billions of dollars a year in armaments. Israel, take a look at the Saudi Arabians and their form of Wahhabism, which is a very radical form of Islam, which has been around a long time, hundreds of years. Also take a look at what we supported when we took one side in Iraq and eliminated the Baathists, eliminated the Sunnis from any position of power, and how that caused the entire infrastructure, which was at least under Saddam Hussein, as bad as he was as a dictator, at least they had members of the Shiite community in some positions of authority and power. And now take a look at what we've created. And in spite of all this, and here's where my question is going, we have had Israel doing everything humanly possible to provoke a conflict with Iran or to do one on their own unilaterally, knowing they would have the full backing and support of the United States government. And I'm thinking, does any American understand how large Iran is, how many people in Iran, over 83 million people, how many of them are actually more liberalized and more friendly to the West than what they believe? They'd like everyone to believe it's a pure theocracy with no one having any challenge. And what it would mean is if there would be no blowback to stopping the production or the floating of oil out of that country through the straits, that Saudi Arabia's oil would not be attacked, that other countries supporting Saudi Arabia and the United States and Israel would not be attacked. Do they have any idea that if we couldn't defeat the Vietnamese, if we couldn't defeat Afghanistan's Taliban, if we couldn't defeat insurgents in Iraq, all puny compared to Iran, what in the world are they thinking about could be the consequences to having a war with Iran? Your thoughts.
My thoughts are very, very clear on this. And the first thought is that I think we have to understand the history of the Middle East in the past 30 years or so as a history in which the United States has been the overwhelmingly the dominant destabilizing force in that region over and over again. As you've suggested in your intro to that question, the United States has played the role of destabilization with horrible consequences. And of course, instead of learning the lesson of the past, as we should have in Afghanistan, which should have taught us not to try to destabilize a country with the support of Mujahideen, we tried to take over Iraq with the consequence of destabilization of the country and creating a much larger jihadist force there that then metastasized throughout the rest of of Lebanon, Syria, of course, and Yemen, as well as elsewhere in the Middle East. Now, today we see the United States playing that role with the assistance of or with the collaboration of the Saudis, who have now become the active destabilizing force in both Syria and in Yemen. They are carrying out a major war, an air war in Yemen, which has resulted in war crimes there that Amnesty International has identified and documented, but which have not been reported by the mainstream media in the United States. And of course, in Syria, the Saudis, the Qataris, in collaboration with the United States, have armed the people collaborating with the al-Nusra Front, have created a powerful force there that has basically been the primary reason why you see the Russians now intervening militarily, because of the major gains that essentially the al-Qaeda franchise in Syria made this year in northwest Syria. And so I think we have to take to heart the degree to which the United States has been the destabilizing force in the Middle East all these years. Now, I think that begs the question, why is it that the U.S. government never seems to learn the lessons of the past, of its experiences? And I think the answer to that is very clear, that the reason these policies have been followed has had nothing to do with the interests of the American people. They have everything to do with the interests of a small elite who stand astride, who lead these major powerful national security organizations or institutions of the United States. And it is in the interests of those institutions and of the individuals who have led them and who have then gone on to positions in private industry, which gained contracts because of their involvement in those policies when they were in the government, that we have a set of consistently disastrous policies that have nevertheless been very good for national security institutions and their private sector allies.
What do you foresee? I realize this is purely subjective, but you're an expert in this area, so your opinion will hold some weight. What do you see the likely outcome if there is a war with Iran, either by Israel, backed by the United States, or other coalitions with Israel?
Well, first of all, let me just comment very briefly on what you had to say about Iran. I completely agree that that any sane, objective assessment of the Middle Eastern countries and their governments would conclude that the most moderate, the sanest, the most rational actor in the Middle East for the past generation, for the past 35 years since the Islamic Republic of Iran was created, has been Iran. And there's a very, I think it's a very understandable reason for that. The Iranians represent a culture which has for at least the last few centuries been not aggressive militarily, but has in fact been has carried the brunt of outsiders' aggressiveness. And this is the only Shia-led regime in the history of humankind. And as a result of that, because it is a Shia government, a government which is governed by Shia jurisprudence, you have a very strong, very powerful, forbidding of owning any weapons of mass destruction. This is the only government in the history of humankind which has said we cannot possess or develop weapons of mass destruction. And this is something that I document in my book, the book on the nuclear program of Iran and how it's been misrepresented in the United States and in the news media. This is an extraordinary situation because this is an opportunity that the United States and its allies should have taken advantage of. But instead, of course, it was necessary for their own vested interests, the bureaucratic political interests, which I referred to a little bit earlier, to have Iran as an enemy or as an adversary and as supposedly a threat to the stability of the region and to American interests for all of these past 3.5 decades. And I think that's really the tragedy that we've seen unfold in the last decade particularly. So to go directly to your question about the possibility of a war with Iran, you know, there's no doubt that the Bush administration neoconservative core group of officials did in fact plan to carry out regime change through military force in Iran, and I document that in my book. It was opposed. It was made impossible by the fact that they were not able to consolidate power over Iraq, which was, in a sense, the necessary precondition for carrying out that policy. But that's what they intended to do, and that policy then, you know, has been rejected by the U.S. military ever since 2007, 2008. And the Obama administration definitely is opposed to it. Now, unfortunately, we cannot predict what the next administration is going to be thinking, particularly given the lineup of Republicans, potential Republican candidates for the White House. And that is very, very worrisome. And I have to say that I take the threat of a U.S.-Israeli war against Iran still very seriously because there is this predisposition on the part of the Republican Party, the pro-Israeli part of the U.S. Political establishment, to want to carry out regime change and to be ready to use force to do so. Okay. So there is still that possibility.
All right. Well, the Syrian-Iranian alliance goes back to the late 1970s after the revolution overthrew the Shah, and both have been accused of foiling peace efforts in the region, particularly between Arabs and Israel. And Syria's ruling party, or the Alawites, are Shiite, as is Iran. And although Syria's government is strictly secular and socialist, while Iran is theocratic, and both have been accused of being tyrannical dictatorships. And for that reason, the Council on Foreign Relations and other U.S. think tanks hold that the strategy is both governments must go, as if we have a right to determine what countries' government policy should be. And on the one hand, there were strong voices debunking the official U.S.-Israeli image of Iran as the horrible nuclear monster in the Middle East. And Iran hasn't invaded another country, from what I'm able to research myself, in over 300 years. Yet the United States has either caused the democratically elected governments of nations to be overturned, engaged in coups or active acts of war in over 59 countries in the last 100 years. So we're certainly not the moniker of peace, freedom, and democracy. And Iran hasn't invaded anyone, but we caused the invasion of Iran. We, the United States and our allies, supported Saddam Hussein in trying to destroy Iran. An Iraq-Iran war lasted 8 years, and over 1 million Iranians died. And that is a matter of historical record. We unseated Mossadegh, the democratically elected prime minister of Iran, and put the Shah of Iran in. Does anyone in U.S. foreign policy have a single sentence they could utter to show that that was a good thing for the people of Iran? And yet we have people talking as if they're knowledgeable on the subject, and they're not, in the media. These are simply ideologues, the fascists at Fox News, and it's embarrassing how bad this has become. So,
yes, and you know, one of the problems that I have with the Obama administration at this point, one of many problems that I have with their policy in the Middle East, is that they continue, despite the fact that they were right in negotiating the nuclear agreement with Iran. That was a very important thing to have accomplished. But in so doing, they have continued to argue that Iran is the adversary, the threat to destabilize the Middle East, the biggest threat to U.S. interests and to the interests of all of the people of the Middle East, whereas, in fact, they must know very well that it is the Saudis who are the active destabilizing force in both Syria and in Yemen. And in both cases, of course, they have taken action, the Saudis have taken action, and the United States has supported them in some ways. In both Yemen and in Syria, actively supported the Saudi policies. And in so doing, they have given the Iranians either an opportunity to have greater influence, as is in the case with Yemen, or, as in the case in Syria, they have actually drawn the Iranians into a war that certainly the Iranians would not have been involved in, but for the appearance of the Islamic State and al-Qaeda forces over the last 4 years in that country. In other words, the U.S. policy has helped by embracing the regime change objective and collaborating with the Saudis to try to build up an alternative, a force that could overthrow the Assad regime, or at least put enough pressure to force Assad to resign and to leave the country. They have, in fact, created, again, another level of Frankenstein's monster that now has certainly invited both the Iranians and the Russians to play an active military role in that country. So, again, we see this repeated theme of the United States in every situation doing exactly the opposite of what they should be doing. And I'm sorry to say that I think that it is because of the vested bureaucratic interests in many cases, and because of the political interest as perceived by the White House, that the United States continues on this disastrous course.
I appreciate these insights. Let us not forget that ISIS can now blossom from the ashes to the heights it has, earning $1 to $2 million a day simply from oil sales, without stating the case of U.S. counterterrorism incompetency. And the rest of the world should see this. How do they make their money? How do they transfer their money? As if somehow we're ignorant of all this. We're not ignorant of anything. But I appreciate you giving us these very important insights. So please hold your thoughts there, Dr. Gareth Porter. Now to my next guest, Professor Stephen Zunes, Z-U-N-E-S. He's a professor of political and international studies, University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle Eastern studies. He's recognized as one of the country's leading scholars of U.S. Middle East policy and of strategic nonviolent action. He received his Ph.D. from Cornell University and previously served on the faculty at Ithaca College, as well as the University of Puget Sound and Whitman College. He serves as a senior policy analyst for the Foreign Policy and Focus Project of the Institute of Policy Studies. He is also associate editor of Peace Review and a contributing editor of Tykan, and chair of the Academic Advisory Committee for the International Center for Nonviolent Conflict. And among his publications, the most recent is Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Resolution. And earlier, Tinderbox, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Roots of Terrorism, co-written with Richard Falk. His website is stephenzunes.org, which has over 400 of his articles. Nice to have you with us today.
My pleasure.
When we look at events during the Obama administration's attempt to take out the Assad government, one was our supporting certain Syrian factions opposed to the social Baathist government in the aftermath of the small Arab Spring that occurred in Syria. If Assad's government had not relied upon violence to squash the demonstrations, Syria may not be the premier humanitarian disaster today. Some 4 million Syrian citizens, minimally, have been driven from the country now. To my understanding, the majority of the armed factions opposing Assad, such as the Free Syrian Army, have been predominantly Sunni and more likely of the Salafi literalist worldview. From these many factions, as well as militant groups still operative in Iraq, there emerged the Islamic State, which then ran roughshod over the region. Now, in the independent media, we're finding two opposing views regarding the U.S. relationship to ISIS. The more radical left claims the Obama administration and its allies are supporting ISIS efforts to remove the Assad government. The other view is our failed Middle East policies in support of more moderate anti-Assad factions, which are also fundamentalist and jihadist, and therefore is indirectly supporting the spread of ISIS. So please take us through the course of events that gave rise to ISIS, primarily within the Syrian chaos, what enabled the caliphate to come to power, and how and in what way either the U.S. directly or supported ISIS or indirectly has contributed to ISIS expansion through its failed Middle Eastern strategies.
Well, just let me start with Syria itself. The United States has long had Syria in its target. The regime there, though quite repressive and increasingly unpopular with its own people, was a left-leaning secular nationalist government with an independent foreign policy that the United States could not control, and that was that led to putting, especially during the Bush administration, putting Syria within its sights. It's somewhat ironic because Syria has collaborated with the United States in some things, going back to Operation Desert Shield against the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in 1991. We supported a coup against in Lebanon against General Aoun, who ironically later became an ally. They supported us in the so-called Extraordinary Rendition Program of torturing al-Qaeda suspects. But despite this collaboration, in general, the U.S. Wanted Assad to go. The popular uprising that began as a broad-based, nonviolent, pro-democracy movement in March of 2011 took the United States by surprise. But there are some very limited support to some of these groups. Eventually, though, largely through defecting soldiers and others, a group known as the Free Syrian Army emerged, ostensibly to protect the nonviolent protesters, but of course this just gave the regime an excuse to suppress them even more. And the U.S. Started giving support to the FSA, tried to get them to have some kind of unified political stance. That proved problematic because the so-called Free Syrian Army was no less than 1,000 different armed units that were not in coordination with each other. Some of them actually were relatively moderate, but a number of them were actually a pretty hardline and extremist. And some more overtly extremist group, like the Al-Nusra Front, which was getting some support from U.S. allies in the Gulf, emerged as a major force. And then along came ISIS. ISIS is largely Iraqi-led. The leading commanders are former members of the Saddam's armed forces that the U.S. Made redundant, if you will, by abolishing the Iraqi armed forces. Many of the ISIS leaders were people who were in U.S. internment camps and were tortured. Some of them were actually moderates when they arrived in these American prisons, but they left radicals after being tortured and abused. The U.S. continued to support the Maliki regime in Syria, which is a sectarian Shiite group which discriminated against the Sunni Sunni minority. The United States, in addition to abolishing the army, also abolished the other bastion of secular nationalism in Iraq, basically the civil service, by saying, you know, nobody who has ever a member of the Ba'ath Party could be in government, but given that most people in the civil service were required to join the Ba'ath Party, that essentially meant, almost everybody in any government position, any bureaucrat was gone, and so the army was replaced by the sectarian Shiite militia, and the government ministries were replaced by became these fiefdoms of the sectarian Shiite parties, and this led to the emergence of hardline Sunni chauvinists fighting the hardline Shia chauvinists. And it included the emergence of Al Qaeda in Iraq, many in the Sunni populated areas thought these guys were so crazy, so extreme, that it might be better to work with the government. So they signed an agreement with the Iraqi government that said, if you incorporate us into the military and government, we will help you in the United States fight Al Qaeda in Iraq. And that it was this kind of arrangement, not the so-called surge, that temporarily calmed things down for a time in Iraq. But then the Maliki government refused to go in on their end of the deal. Nonviolent protests by the Sunnis in Iraq were brutally suppressed. And so when ISIS emerged out of the remnants of Al Qaeda, the Sunnis in Iraq initially welcomed them. They're able to use this base to spread into Syria to take advantage of the deteriorating situation there. My view is that the United States is genuinely disturbed at the rise of ISIS. We are not directly funding them or supporting them. However, there's no question that U.S. policy is, especially the invasion of Iraq and our post-invasion of occupation policies, were directly responsible for their rise. And our propensity to send arms, massive amounts of arms, to various allies in the Middle East, whether it be Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the Baghdad regime, or elsewhere, has resulted in over half of ISIS's military equipment being U.S.-made. Again, we'd not give it to them directly, but our recklessness in sending arms over there that that ISIS then captures from the so-called moderate rebels in Iraq and the Iraqi government and perhaps through clandestine sources in the Gulf. So ISIS is not, I would argue, a U.S. creation. We're not directly supporting it, but it sure as hell is a direct consequence of U.S. policies.
All right, let me try to put this in perspective for the audience and see if I'm accurately condensing what you said. During the Iraqi conflict, our neocons, including Bremer, Paul Bremer, who was the person who oversaw the re-administration of all efforts in Iraq, decided that they wanted to purge completely Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist party, even though the Ba'athists were principally Sunni, and the Sunnis made up the minority of the population compared to the Shia. The Shia were dominant, but they were not given the same preferential treatment as the Sunnis. The trouble is that the armed forces, the intelligence agencies, the bureaucracy of police and fire and city administration and garbage collection and all these basic efforts that are necessary to hold a society together were run by the Ba'athist Party. And in he came and simply disempowered all of it, took away all their weapons or threw them all out of work. And now you had a large number, some estimate anywhere from 50 to 80,000 people who had been employed, who were no longer employed. And then during this period of time...
Actually, it was well into the hundreds of thousands, actually. It was,
okay.
If you count the military and the government, it could actually be at least a million.
Okay. Well, now...
And I should emphasize that even though that Saddam Hussein's inner circle were... mostly fellow Sunnis from the Crete area, there were Shias and other minorities in high positions of government. I mean, his vice president and foreign minister, for example, was a Christian. And at least a third of the top leaders in the Ba'ath Party were Shia. So he could be quite repressive against Shiite groups that... he saw as extremists or challenging his power, and of course, he'd use collective punishment as a lot of governments do. But the Ba'ath Party under Saddam was actually secular in orientation, and that's one of the big tragedies of the situation. The sectarianism that we see in Iraq is a relatively new thing. Intermarriage between Sunnis and Shias was not uncommon, particularly in urban areas and small towns where there is a single mosque, Sunnis and Shias would worship together. I mean, theologically, there's less difference between Sunnis and Shias than there are between Catholics and Protestants. This is the sectarian conflict we see in Iraq is very much and which resulted in the rise of ISIS very much, I would argue, the fault of the U.S. invasion.
All right. We also saw during this period of time the beginning of sectarian violence, and also a great deal of people being targeted for arrest and imprisonment or torture by the U.S. allies from the people who, whatever reason they had, were dropping a dime on people. And at one time, you had tens of thousands of people who were, for all intents and purposes, prisoners in their country. And we are told, correctly or incorrectly, that a substantial number of the people that would later become members of these different radical jihadist groups came from that environment. Could you explain to us if that is true in part or whole?
Yes, a number of the prominent ISIS leaders, including al-Baghdadi, the most prominent one, were indeed in U.S. Prisons, where they were subject to torture and other forms of abuse. Indeed, the people who tended to be in U.S. prisons were not even necessarily armed fighters beforehand. It was routine that if there was an ambush or some incident threatening U.S. forces, the U.S. Army would round up every male between the age of 15 and 50, pretty much. And in some prisons, like the notorious Abu Ghraib, 80 to 90% of the people there really had not engaged in any kind of armed resistance to the United States. but they were still subjected to that kind of abuse. And if you were not an anti-American extremist before you entered such an environment, you very well could be by the time you got out.
How much of U.S. involvement in Syria now can be traced back to the neocon agenda outlined to support Israel in the late 1990s? And is the current course Obama is following still in alignment with the GOP's and the corporate Democrats' neopolitical agenda for the Middle East, or has Obama veered into a different direction?
Obama's been a lot more cautious. Any American president would like to see the region controlled by governments that are friendly to U.S. strategic and economic interests. But he also recognized that the neocon agenda, such as the invasion of Iraq, which was supported by Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden, John Kerry, and other people who end up playing major roles in his administration, was reckless and dangerous. It was overreach. I've seen absolutely no evidence that the Obama administration, was behind, the initial uprising in Syria, the nonviolent phase, which was largely spontaneous. Indeed, many of these forces in the nonviolent movement were pretty left-leaning and anti-imperialist themselves. What I see Obama doing is just trying to keep a lid on things because he recognizes there aren't very many good options. You have the Assad regime, which is does not support U.S. interest, and you have ISIS, which does not support U.S. interest. Atrocities being committed by both sides, of course. But he's under a lot of pressure, to militarize the situation. He was under a lot of pressure to bomb the Syrian regime a couple years ago, and more recently he's been pressured to bomb ISIS, which he has to some degree. I think frankly, Obama has been shown a real reluctance to further militarize the conflict, not because he's weak, as Republicans could say, not because he's a pacifist, not because he's particularly progressive in his foreign policy view, but I think he's just smart enough to recognize it's a quagmire, it's a mess, and he doesn't want to see the U.S. dragged down in yet another war. I think he thinks recognizes, if you will, there are more the more subtle and ultimately more effective means of advancing American empire than being dragged into yet another armed conflict.
We have witnessed something similar in the past when the Israeli government had supported Hamas during its early days to serve as a knife to split Palestinian allegiance to Arafat and the PLO. And we know the results. Hamas, in turn, became Israel's most fierce nemesis. So hasn't the U.S. been falling into the same trap in some ways by supporting groups that only appear on the surface as moderates, but may have more in common with al-Qaeda or al-Nusra Front and other organizations that can properly be defined as terrorists?
I think U.S. did make some mistakes in its support for the Free Syrian Army and the armed groups. I mean, I think they saw that the nonviolent movement, was indeed pretty pretty broad-based and not extreme, and I thought they perhaps mistakenly thought that as the movement shifted more towards armed struggle, it would maintain that kind of a similar diverse collection. But of course, what we've seen throughout history really is when popular movements are suppressed, then popular nonviolent movements are suppressed, and they take up arms. That often is an opening for the more extreme elements to come to the fore. And in many ways, that's the nature of armed struggle. You have this, this strict hierarchy of command and control, and martial values, and the like, and that tends to bring more authoritarian tendencies to the fore. Not to mention that often when things are so desperate, as it's been for the Syrian people, when people are desperate, they'll tend to embrace religion, often in a very rigid, dogmatic way. I've read a number of stories of these young Syrian men who were, nominally Muslim, but were not particularly observant, in the course of the struggle, becoming increasingly radicalized and started growing beards and started reading accepting some of these more extreme Salafist interpretations of Islam and the like, I think many of these people were folks that the U.S. initially supported, thinking they would remain moderate, they are either their ideology shifted in the course of the struggle, or their weapons were captured, or their hatred of Assad was so extreme they were willing to join the extremists just because they thought they were a more effective fighting force. But for whatever reason, I think you're correct that in supporting our haste to try to get rid of Assad, we may have ended up contributing to the rise of these extremist elements.
I'm not as apologetic and supportive towards Putin and Russia as are a growing number of people on the American left, and certainly on energy matters. Russia is a major contributor to climate change due to its reliance upon fossil fuel extraction and exports. There are certainly questionable policies on human rights in Russia and other issues to raise suspicions towards Russia. However, there is reason to find some legitimacy to Russia wanting to assist Assad. Russia's only major access to the Mediterranean is its base at Tartus in Syria. And unlike the U.S., it faces Islamic extremism on its borders with Chechnya and Dagestan and elsewhere, and it can potentially face it in Crimea. Mm-hmm. If we're to believe media reports not influenced by the U.S. intelligence, Putin has severely injured ISIS and other jihad organizations in the region, and it would seem that there is now a glimmer of hope among the victims of ISIS because of its retreat. So what is your analysis of Putin's decision to commence airstrikes against all terrorist groups in Syria in light that we now have two major powers, U.S. and Russia, possibly being joined by China, directly militarizing the Syrian conflict? And do you foresee any blowback or serious repercussions that Putin might face because of this military decision?
I frankly don't think the Russian bombing is making much of a strategic difference. Whatever tactical military advantage it may gain, and I think will be lost in terms of the ability of ISIS and other extremist groups to play on the nationalist sentiments by Arabs who don't like being bombed by European powers, whether they be East or West. Same reason I've opposed the U.S. bombing of ISIS and the French bombing of ISIS and the Saudi bombing of ISIS and the Jordanian bombing of ISIS and the British bombing of ISIS, et cetera. That it's it's very hypocritical, I think, for the United States to criticize what Russia is doing, but I don't think it's any better than what the United States has been doing, frankly. I mean, Russia does have its strategic interest in doing it. That's certainly true, but in many ways, we forget that the Middle East to Russia is like Central America is to the United States, in that it's a close by region, and we remember how the U.S. Overreacted whenever we perceived, usually incorrectly, of Soviet penetration and Soviet influence on our southern flank, and think of all the thuggish dictators and death squads and nasty groups the U.S. Supported. Russia has far greater reason to be concerned about U.S. Penetration on its southern flank. But at the same time, I don't think that justifies supporting thuggish dictators like Assad.
Okay. There is a contradiction I have not been able to understand, which raises the question of Israel's hidden role in the Syrian civil war. One would expect that ISIS poses a serious future threat to Israel. Therefore, we might expect Israel to welcome Russia's intervention to destroy ISIS, though that is not going to be done militarily, and I think any wise person would understand that. There has to be a different approach, including diplomacy. And because I personally believe Islamic Jihad militarism represents a very serious long-term threat to Israel, far more than Assad's government ever has. And although there were several Israeli-Syrian conflicts during Assad's father's regime in 1948, later in the 1960s and 70s, that is just my personal opinion. Yet Israel has come forth to express its concern over Russia's involvement. How do you account for this, and what would be the reasons for Israel's concern about Russia's riding in on its platform to challenge Islamic terrorist groups that the U.S. has failed dismally to accomplish?
I think it's the same reason the United States is concerned, even though we oppose ISIS as well. I think it's just that we don't want to see a government that is not friendly to U.S. or Israeli interest, play an increasing role in that part of the world. Back in the Soviet days, Soviet and Israeli jets engaged in dogfights in both Egypt and Lebanon, Syria. Russians have been killed by Israeli airstrikes, and Israelis have been killed to a lesser degree by Russians. So, there is some bad blood between the two going back. And it's interesting that Assad actually made an overture for peace with Israel back in 2007, and the Israeli cabinet was considering it, but Condoleezza Rice and the Bush administration basically told the Israelis, don't even think about it. We were afraid that a successful peace agreement whereby Syria would have the Golan region that had been occupied by Israel since 1967 returned to them would be a political victory that would strengthen Assad's rule. We didn't want that. So we convinced the Israelis not to pursue it. But the Israelis know that the Assad regime is actually interested in peace. They know ISIS is pretty crazy. And I guess, some people are think the Israelis might be Machiavellian enough to encourage extremists so they can it can be an excuse for continued militarism. I mean, nothing scares the current Israeli government like Arabs willing to make peace. But at the same time, I think the Israelis are actually have not been major players in the in what's happening in Syria, except for border regions or areas along their occupied territory in the southwestern part of the country, I've been highly, highly critical of the Israeli government on many, many, many issues, and have been widely attacked by organizations and individuals that support the Israeli government as a result. But I think in this particular case, I really I don't see Israel playing a particularly major role.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being on and sharing your insights with us.
My pleasure.
Professor Stephen Zunis from San Francisco, professor of politics and international studies, University of San Francisco, and an author of a very important book on the subject. And you can go to his website, Stephen Zunis, ZUNES.org. I'm Gary Nall. This has been the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you very much for listening. Have a nice day.